Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And today I'm going to be talking a little bit about Sino-Soviet relationships in the mid-1950s to early 1960s and the Sino-Soviet split. But I'm going to be talking about it from the perspective of East Germany, of all places. The reason I'm going to be doing this is I've unearthed a superb article recently on this very subject, and the relationship between the East German government and China is very revealing on a whole number of levels. Okay, so firstly, the scholarship comes from Quinn Slobodian, who writes in the Journal of Contemporary History. That was this year. And he's got some fascinating insights to make. And it's a really superbly researched piece of work. So in the period from the Chinese Revolution through to the early 1950s, there was an interesting relationship between East Germany and China. They inhabit the communist world, but really they are quite far apart in their approaches to communism. The state of East Germany is created in 1949, as is communist China, created in the same year. And there is a certain degree of fraternity between the two nations, both mindful that they have come into existence about the same time. And this is at a real high point for Stalinism in general. And it's at a point where much of the Western world, America, and her European allies feel quite embattled and imperiled, and this is also just on the eve of the Korean War. But very quickly, in the early 1950s onwards, fractures begin to emerge in the relationship between Moscow and Beijing. The first thing that occurs is that Beijing is angered by Moscow's relatively diffident and sort of slightly unenthusiastic response to the outbreak of the Korean War. It would appear that in the early 1950s, Stalin is already moving, long before the likes of Khrushchev do, already moving towards a more slightly more accommodationist and less confrontational stance with the Western world. And the Chinese are particularly displeased with this notion. When Stalin dies and Khrushchev comes to power, it is, as I've mentioned before, when I've talked about the secret speech and Mao's Hundred Flowers campaigns, these are podcasts going back a way, there's explosion of anger from Beijing when Stalin is denounced by Khrushchev, because the implication is that Stalin's most eager pupil, Mao Zedong, is also tarred with the same brush. There's a sense in Beijing that Moscow has kind of retreated from a confrontation with capitalism, and that this new spirit of accommodation and peaceful coexistence and a decision to focus instead of furthering revolution and conflict and militarism, communist militarism, on developing living standards within the Soviet bloc. This is, in Mao's eyes, a total abrogation of socialism. And as far as Mao is concerned, communism is about confrontation, is about confronting capitalism wherever it's, it can be confronted. And this is to be done in the Third World. This is to be done in colonial struggles. And this is where Mao really comes to believe that the peasantry of the Third World are the anti-capitalist, the communist vanguard. Communist countries like East Germany exist based on the core tenets of communist ideology. The state retains the right to interpret Marx and to present the version of Marxist-Leninism that it believes to be valid. And therefore, schisms within the communist world are a grave threat to countries like East Germany, a grave threat to their sense of self. One of the problems that East Germany faces by the 1960s is that Maoism has become, amongst some of the workers, some of the intelligentsia, and some of the student bodies, quite a popular idea. The East Germany of Walter Ulbricht is, for a whole range of reasons, its repressiveness, the violence and bloodshed of the 1953 crackdown against strikers, and the some of the graft and venality of officials, is extremely unpopular in certain quarters, those aforementioned, the various aspects of the intelligentsia. And there is a kind of a growing popularity for Maoism, as it is seen by, particularly on the left of the German Communist Party, as a more authentic telling of the communist story, a more authentic interpretation of communism. A lot of these guys are the real old guard of the Communist Party. They joined the KPD, the German Communist Party, in the 1920s, during the period of kind of feuding and division between the Communist Party and the Social Democrats, who were referred to by Stalin as social fascists. Until Stalin, by the time Stalin hoped to build a united, a popular front between social democracy and communism, it's way too late, and both forces have been wiped out by Hitler after the Reichstag fire in 1933. So the old guard of the German Communist Party were far more inclined to embrace what they believed to be a kind of a more purist version, a more purist interpretation of communism, and they do so with gusto when Mao becomes this kind of extremely attractive popular figure. And it's interesting that by the late 1960s, Maoism amongst the students in West Germany is also extremely popular, as Soviet communism, particularly in Western Europe, becomes less and less attractive to the kind of the left fellow travellers. So Maoism suddenly becomes a much more agreeable notion. This, of course, rather kind of presupposes that nobody really knew about Mao's famine of the late 50s and the early 60s, which I'm sure a great many people actually. So it's for these reasons that the East German government took the Chinese challenge to their monopoly on the sole interpretation of the nature of communism as such an existential threat. It's particularly interesting that the first real point of departure between the two regimes comes in 1960, when the Chinese government speaks out, a Chinese representative speaks out in the East German press, extolling the virtues of communes. The Chinese government had instituted mass agricultural communes in China, which is part of the reason that there was an apocalyptic famine, and the Germans had, the East Germans had looked with particular dread and disgust at the example of Soviet collectivization of agriculture. And the Chinese example had been disastrous, more disastrous than the Soviet example by a factor of about 10 in terms of deaths. And about 5 to 7 million people in the Ukrainian famine. The Chinese famines are anything between 45 and perhaps 70 or 80 million a year. If you read Frank Dakota's book Mao's Great Famine, the statistics look at it probably about 55 million, and you know, could potentially go much, much higher. Statistics on famines are notoriously volatile things. So the Chinese were asked really not to mention.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Communes at all, and the references to them in the East German press are removed, and the nervous East German agricultural community were told that they would not be collectivised. And that again gives us a clue, doesn't it, about the kind of the limits of totalitarianism in East Germany, the things that the state, the calculations that the state makes about what they can and cannot get away with. And it's entirely possible that in East Germany it was just understood really that collectivisation was an epic mistake. Walter Ulbricht, who had been a Comintern agent and had represented Stalin during the Spanish Civil War as part of the German International Brigades, a widely loathed figure who had contributed really to many of the deaths of his comrades and seemingly managed to emerge quite successfully at the end of the Second World War, and establish himself by 1949. Walter Ulbricht obviously decides to side with Stalin, side with the Soviet Union, actually, this is long after Stalin's death, I beg your pardon, side with the Soviet Union against China, but he does so really without being lent upon by Moscow particularly. He decides ahead of time upon which side he chooses to be, and says that there is basically no Chinese version of Marxism, that And this is a rejection of what is referred to as Mao Zedong thought. And this is a kind of the clear throwing down of the gauntlet by East Germany to the Chinese. The East German Stasi go on an epic information management mission, hoovering up hundreds of thousands of copies of books of Mao Zedong thought. Small Germano-Sino film collaboration projects, in which films of the joyous, happy, revolutionary people's Chinese peasantry are shown in various German state cinemas. These are all rounded up and burned. Various articles, travel guides from China, and other kinds of books are got rid of. And in Erfurt, the ring road there, the Mao Zedong ring, is renamed after the astronaut Yuri Gagarin, cosmonaut, a big one. And so the Chinese actually turn around and say to the East Germans, you know, this is kind of the sort of censorship you would see in the capitalist world. You know, this is wrong, and you know, you're really kind of the bully, Moscow's bullying kind of lapdog. There is another factor really about the East German experience in that East Germany is one of the communist countries that has obviously a capitalist neighbour in West Germany, and it has a long-term sense of kind of insecurity, paranoia and siege about West Germany. The official narrative is really that West Germany is really still kind of Nazi. You know, it is. If you look at a communist interpretation of what Nazism is simply really capitalism's attack dog. And now pretense of Nazism is being dropped, and capitalism runs riot over the border, and it will at some point rearm itself and attack. And this is the kind of the anxiety that is written really into the DNA of the East German state. And so there is a sense that there are enemies to the West, but also that the communist world now is not the kind of the united, happy, fraternal place it once was. There are challenges within the communist world too. And East Germany is, you know, perhaps not the geographically the vastest, the largest of communist states, but it is such a focus for Cold War tensions, such a focus for Soviet ambitions, particularly in the first part of the Cold War, that it really is quite a core, an essential part of the communist world. And a key site, really, of this particular drama. Some of the more eager participants in the Sino-Soviet split, particularly in East Germany, weren't East Germans themselves, but students from what would be described now as the Global South, students from Africa, from South America, and from parts of Asia. You find across Eastern Europe various capitals host to communist students from places like Cuba and Angola, even countries where there is no communist government, but there are members of trade unions or communist parties or students with communist views are able to study in places like East Germany, in Poland, in Hungary, and particularly in the Soviet Union. And the attitudes that are common amongst students can be seen in the article that I mention are particularly exemplified by students from Cuba, who in the early 1960s is at the height of Cold War tensions and really ready to, as Khrushchev is trying to move towards some kind of détente post-missile crisis, you have Cuban students who believe that places like Cuba are the only countries left really with any fight in them. And that the Americans, and there is plenty of evidence for this, are really the kind of the main expansionist power overthrowing democratically elected governments across South America. And that these are students who are well aware that as détente exists, as the Soviets and the Americans are unwilling to fight one another, so proxy wars in South America, in Africa, and in Asia become more and more likely. And indeed, throughout the 1960s and 70s, the Cold War is largely fought through proxy wars, and with immense and horrific bloodshed, as we know, in most parts of the Third World. Mostly for the East German authorities, these students from Africa and Asia proved little more than a kind of a mild annoyance. You know, periodically have to go and take down their flags from student dormitories, but not much else other than that. I imagine there was an immense amount of unnecessary effort involved in following them around and recording largely inconsequential conversations. But the appeal of China doesn't really kind of percolate down to the bulk of East German society. And if anything, you know, traditionally sort of bigoted anti-Asian attitudes come to the fore. The idea that there is some kind of yellow peril, any sort of internationalist solidarity is largely lost on the bulk of the population, who instead say that we've got more in common with the rest of non-communist Europe, and frankly it might be an idea for Europeans in general to forget these ideological differences and unite before the Asian horde march over us. And these are obviously kind of not new ideas at all. These are ideas that kind of echo not just throughout German rhetoric in the 20th century, but they are it's a pan-European phenomenon. So I think it's a really interesting article. I'll see if I can get away with, and let's face it, large academic publishers don't like this kind of thing. I'll read the small print very carefully and see if I can get away with posting it on the Explaining History website. If not, I will put a URL under this video or audio if you're getting on the podcast. And it's well worth a read. If you are looking for a grounding in the history of Soviet communism, my new free course is online. Again, there'll be a link under this podcast. Check it out. This is an introduction to Stalin's Russia, and I'll be posting the next couple of short courses on Stalinism at some point in the near future. Anyway, I hope you find this useful, and I'll look forward to catching you on the next Explaining History podcast. Thanks, bye-bye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.